This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. So what do you know about dog breeds? Well, you probably know that golden retrievers are loving, German shepherds are fiercely loyal, and that pit bulls are mean, angry, and aggressive. Well, at least that's what popular culture tells us. But my guest today says after 7 years of research and more than 350 interviews, she can conclusively say that much of what we think we know about pit bulls is based on myth and misinformation. Her new book is called Pit Bull, The Battle Over an American Icon. It traces the science of dog breeding, examines the history of dog fighting, and looks at how modern-day understanding of pit bulls is shaped by prejudices about race and class. Bronwyn Dickey will be reading from her book in Durham and Raleigh this week, but first she joins me on the program. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us, first of all, how you came to write this book and get interested in the subject in the first place.
Sure. It started back in 2008. I had never been around pit bulls. I had no experience with them, and I didn't even realize that only a very small fraction of them were involved in the crime of dog fighting. I thought that if you had one, you were probably endorsing that crime in some way. And then my friends had one, and I spent an evening with their dog, and she was amazing. So I began to wonder, just as a journalist, if she was an outlier, or if maybe my perceptions needed to be questioned a little bit. So I did some research, and I found that veterinarians and animal scientists were saying that these stories that came out of the 1980s about these dogs being super predators were highly inaccurate. They weren't based in science. They were mostly hype, and they were doing a lot of damage. So I decided to keep checking it out, and I fell down a rabbit hole I never quite got out of.
One of the first errors is our belief that there is a pit bull, right?
Right, right. Yeah. That's a huge problem. So many people refer to the pit bull as a breed, when in fact the definition of pit bull has expanded over the past 100 years to include at least 4 breeds. And now people kind of willy-nilly define any dog with a short coat and a big head as a pit bull. That means that our statistics are terribly inaccurate.
But the pit in pit bull does come from the dog pit where
sure
dogs fight.
Yes.
So somehow this dog has been associated with the viciousness of dog fighting, right?
Right, very much so. Started back in 1889 in Massachusetts with the American Pit Bull Terrier, which was the first formal breed, and that was a fighting dog. But J.P. Colby, lots of his dogs were washouts. Fighting is actually very, very hard to breed for. So he made a very good living in the pet market, and his dogs became very popular. But then there were all these spin-off breeds that were conformation only, and they only had the, misfortune of looking like the original. So they got swept into the net.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting point you make in your book, is that while a pit bull might be in the pit fighting, it might have been one of a litter or several litters. And so very few actual pit bulls grow up to be vicious fighters.
Very much. Yeah. And even the dogs that were specifically bred for that purpose when that was legal, if one in a litter had the actual, kind of machinery and temperament to be able to do that, that was considered a very high success rate. So the historical estimates usually place the number of pit bulls actually matched between 1 and 10%. Yeah. So this idea that all pit bulls are fighting dogs is really inaccurate. And
that you could successfully breed a dog to be a vicious fighter.
Right.
It's a hard thing to do,
it's possible. It's just very hard.
Yeah.
Fighting is not something that's evolutionarily advantageous to the dogs. So even with something like horse racing, where it's just running, that's hard enough to do. If you just bred Seabiscuit, everyone would be a millionaire, but that's not what happens even with a simple trait.
Right.
But fighting is very, very complex.
So tell us more about the breeding. So where's the bull dog come from? The pit bull, the pit terrier, the bull terrier. Why were these dogs bred initially? And then how did they come to be associated with fighting?
The original bulldogs derived from the English Mastiff, but it wasn't the English Mastiff we know today. It was kind of the quintessential dog of the Renaissance in England, was called the Mastiff, and it was just any big dog that could kind of control stock. Those got a little smaller and were used in stockyards, farmyards to control errant bulls, which could go after people and become very dangerous. So that turned into a practice, a horrible form of gambling called bull baiting that Queen Elizabeth was a big fan of. And then the dogs just kind of got smaller and were mixed with terriers around 1800 to be more agile and athletic. But again, most of those dogs were washouts and pets and working dogs.
Obviously, humans have been breeding animals for a long, long time. But you say that there was a real turning point in the late 19th century, particularly in England. Tell us what was going on there.
Huge turning point. 1859 was kind of a big turning point for the way we saw dogs, the way we saw animals, the way we saw ourselves. It was the year that Darwin's Origin of Species was published, and that really uprooted how humans saw themselves and kind of the great chain of being. But it was also the year of the first dog show. So those two things kind of collided, our understanding of heredity and selection and all those things, and just happened to create an enormous Victorian interest in fashion breeding and fad breeding of dogs, which was much easier to do and less expensive than, say, livestock breeding. So the Victorians then began to treat dogs almost as if they were living sculpture. And instead of the world being one of working dogs, it became one of fashion, one of social status, and over three quarters of the 400 breeds we recognize today were created after 1859.
And this connection between social status and breeding is another important aspect of your story. At the high end, we're looking at a certain kind of dog, and the pit bull had been associated with lower classes.
That's right, with butchers, drovers, foundry workers, miners, that kind of thing. And for a long time, that was what made him so popular. In England especially, he was seen as kind of, I mean, there's still the English bulldog, which is very different, but it's still kind of seen as the quintessential British dog, and that got transposed to Americans as well. But yes, it was always kind of the dog of the working man. So the gentry didn't feel too kindly about it. Yet, in the 19th century, the bull terrier, for a while, was the most popular dog in London. So there were these amazing kind of peaks and valleys in the story of these dogs and twists and reversals that made it really interesting to read about.
And this kind of imagery and symbolism is also becoming refined to a high art toward the end of the 19th century. The idea of associating various symbols with class is
very
becoming
much.
And dogs are an important part of that, the pit bull. Let's go back to dog fighting. Sort of what's the evolution of that, and where, you know, is the popularity of dog fighting by, say, the end of the 19th century?
Sure. Well, in 1838, bull baiting was outlawed in the UK. And so since that was no longer available to people who wanted to do that form of gambling, a lot of them turned towards kind of the saloons and taverns and turned toward dog fighting instead. Another way that the Industrial Revolution changed things. It was very popular in American cities until the humane movement kind of got started and pushed those guys out, thank goodness. But probably by the, you know, 19-teens, it was really on its way out. It was not something that people were that interested in anymore. As a whole, I think our society was becoming a lot more aware of animal suffering and was moving away for it. But then kind of in the 1970s, the very well-intentioned desire to eradicate it unfortunately triggered a wave of press coverage that made it more popular.
All right, tell us more about that.
Yeah, this is kind of one of the saddest parts of the story. Is that by 1974, there were very, very few professional dogfighters left in America. I looked through 50 years of underground fighting publications, and I couldn't find a single match report that listed attendees of more than 200 people, maybe. And they were always kind of the same 200 people. I believe there are about 50 dog breeders of fighting dogs, 50. But they were very hard to catch because they operated across state lines. So, and they were involved in a truly horrific and terrible, barbaric form of torture. So, the kind of new, newly active humane movement decided to push for dogfighting to be a felony. And in order to get support for that, because most of the public wasn't aware of what dogfighting was, and they certainly didn't think it could affect them, therefore they weren't going to vote for a law to felonize it, there was kind of a media bonanza that invited people to speculate about the dogs, make wild claims about the dogs, and make everything seem even more awful than it already was. And instead of treating the animals as victims of a terrible crime, it almost cast them as accomplices in it.
Well, and part of that had to do with if you don't care about the dog, think about the impact on crime, and associating those dogs with other forms of crime became the big connection, right?
Exactly, very much. In the 1980s especially, the linking of the pit bull to the drug dealer, the inner city drug dealer, was a huge thing. And what was interesting about that when I was doing the research was that over time, people involved in illicit activities have always had a certain type of dog that they use to guard their operations. So in the 1920s, the mobsters that were, you know, bootlegging, they had what were then called German police dogs or German shepherds. In the 1960s and 70s, it was the Hells Angels had Dobermans and German Shepherds. So there were always these people who had certain favorite breeds, and it just happened to be kind of like a sad game of musical chairs that the pit bull happened to be that dog for the 1980s. But everything got very racialized and very ugly, and the dog was seen as somehow worse than any other dog who had come before.
Well, in the 1980s, as we're about to hear in our next segment, this was part of the Reagan administration project to racialize crime
very much.
To associate race with big government, all of that project, which has now been pretty well documented. It includes pit bulls,
very much, right?
And how did the pit bull becomes the inner city dog, the dog that is now associated with drug dealers who have become associated with African Americans and other minorities, and now the tide has turned for the pit bull. The whole thing is a very, very dangerous prospect for us.
Right, and that's the main reason why the dogs were cast as being somehow worse than any other dogs ever. But those same dealers had Dobermans just 5 years before. Yet the pit bull was a lot more easy to acquire. It was cheaper than an AKC pedigree Doberman or German Shepherd. Easier to house, much smaller. It just kind of became a crazy free-for-all.
Well, let's talk about some of the myths that we think we know about them. I mean, one of the things we think we know about a pit bull is that it has stronger jaws. It will lock on. It doesn't let go. It's more tenacious and therefore more dangerous.
Right. And there's no scientific evidence to back that up at all. The biggest determinant of a dog's bite force or bite strength is its body size, if you think about force being mass times acceleration. There are certainly people who train their dogs in various ways to strengthen their jaw muscles, but it really is about the development of the muscles in the individual dog. Some dogs have it, some dogs don't.
Talk about the impact of Michael Vick's arrest in 2007.
That was huge. Because of Michael Vick's celebrity, when he was arrested on charges related to dogfighting, he was required by the courts, kind of in an unprecedented way, he was required by the courts to pay restitution to the animals that he abused that were seized. So he paid over $900,000 for their rescue and rehabilitation. And because of that, the individual dogs were then followed in the press, and their rehabilitation was followed in the press. And instead of being this kind of faceless category called pit bull, they were individual dogs with individual stories who each had a different reaction to what had happened to them. And most of them were incredibly resilient and came out of it. So, so much social science research has shown us that if you're dealing with a faceless category, it's very hard to care. If you can attach a face and a name to something, then you become a lot more invested in it. So people became very interested in the dogs. They saw they weren't all monsters. And the kind of pit bull rescue movement really, really took off.
Although PETA, I guess, to some extent, there were advocates who worried that that you couldn't rehabilitate an animal, and this worked against some of what was going on.
Sure, and some of the dogs, that's true, they can't. Right. I mean, just like us, some respond to trauma differently.
And it's the training that had as much to do with this.
Sure, well, I mean, also some dogs, I mean, some dogs can certainly be neurologically damaged, right, or the same way that, that humans can be mentally ill. But yeah, there was, they live through very, very extreme situations.
This stirs up a lot of passion, and you have been the recipient of some angry response to all of this, and a lot of fear, it seems, lingers over this issue.
Yeah. Which has been so interesting to me, because I thought especially I wanted to do a very thorough and rigorous book, and I really did believe that people who had strong negative feelings about the dogs deserved a voice in the project, and I wanted to talk to them more and more. And a few of them were kind enough to speak with me. But some, when I reached out to, they didn't just say no. They kind of insulted me. They challenged my motives. It was a very bizarre experience as a journalist. And now those same people are kind of blaming me for getting it wrong when they wouldn't help me get it right, I guess. But I spent so much time looking into facts, and facts are really what's important. There's so much misinformation. There's so much rhetoric. There's so much fear. But it's time people come together and talk about facts like rational adults. But it is, I do think, really important. I hope people understand that saying there's been a lot of misinformation and myth-making around these dogs does not excuse in any way, you know, the dogs that have seriously injured or killed people. And I have tremendous, tremendous sympathy for people who have been through that experience. But I think if we can explain and understand, we're all going to be able to create safer humane communities.
Well, particularly if you understand that this could happen, that the danger might exist in any kind of a dog, depending on. There's nothing particular about the breeding. I mean, that information
very
would be
much
pretty important
so.
To
very
know
much
if you're
so.
Worried about the safety of your children.
Very much. Dogs are capable predators. They have the machinery to break bones and amputate digits. And they're not toys. And we place them in a lot of really tough situations. And we need to kind of, you know, treat them with caution and respect and have some regard for the capable animals that they are. But they're wonderful.
You know, it's interesting. You talked about the myth making, and part of that happens by the way we consume media. So I might have an impression based on stories I've seen, may not be deliberate, but I've got this idea in my head. But you say there's also some deliberate misinformation or some very poor research. I mean, talk about a guy named Merritt Clifton, for one.
Right. Merritt Clifton is he considers himself a journalist. He was a newspaper reporter in Canada for a while. He lives out in Washington State, and he was one of the founders of the Animal People newsletter. He's a pretty hardline animal rights guy, and he publishes what he calls a report of dog maimings and attacks and deaths every year. But it's never been peer-reviewed. It's based only on media reports. There are no citations in it. It doesn't draw from any of the scientific literature. And when I asked him if he would help me out here by providing some of the citations so that I could verify what he said, he was one of the ones who sent me kind of a nasty email saying I wasn't a real journalist and kind of imputing my motives. It was very, very strange. But the media tends to equate someone like Merritt Clifton, who's basing things basically on newspaper clippings, and the CDC, who have, you know, a fleet of trained epidemiologists who have said that breed is not the factor we need to be looking at. It's a lot more complex than that. So I think the media needs to be a lot more skeptical and cautious with who it considers a valid source.
Bronwyn, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bronwyn Dickey is the author of the new book, Pit Bull, The Battle Over an American Icon. She's going to be reading from her book at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham tomorrow night, 7 o'clock. Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, Friday at 7, and you can get all the information at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we'll talk with an author about the high cost and questionable results of the war on drugs. Stay tuned.